Ultrasound Gel Podcast.
Ultrasound Gel Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the Ultrasound Gel Podcast. I'm Mike Pratz, and if you weren't with us last week, let me catch you up to speed. This is going to be part two of a special edition mini-series on critical care point-of-care ultrasound articles. And this was recorded last year in Dublin, Ireland, at a conference with an amazing group of POCUS educators, and also me. This week, we tackle another article and discuss how it relates to our practice. Enjoy.
The title of this paper is Emergency Physician-Informed Tricuspid Annular Plane Systolic Excursion, which is TAPSE, in the Evaluation of Suspected PE, and it was published in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine. The first author is James Daly, who at the time was a third-year resident. Second author is John Groppert, who was a first-year medical student. I'm somewhere down the line.
And also ran in the list, yeah.
The reason why we're interested in this topic in the first place is the cardiology literature has suggested that TAPSE can be a good prognostic indicator for submassive PEs that may go on to turn massive. And we want to know whether in the ED, we can also start picking them up to intervene sooner.
So this is quite specific. It's like saying, does a TAPSE predict a PE? Right. Not just does a TAPSE predict need for reperfusion, or maybe it does. It's also does TAPSE predict PE?
Yeah,
so it's a very different question from the other paper.
We compared TAPSE with a number of other RV strain parameters, including McConnell sign, D-shaped septum. They looked to see if there was a TR jet. And it turns out, so using a TAPSE cutoff of, like, standard TAPSE cutoff of 1.7 centimeters that has been reported in cardiology literature, we have a 56% sensitivity, 79% specificity for PE. Makes a likelihood ratio of 2.6. So part of it was trying to determine for emergency physicians if there was a cutoff for TAPSE that would increase our sensitivity and specificity for PE. And using a receiver operator curve, we determined that using a TAPSE cutoff of 2.0 centimeters, which is higher than the cardiology literature, that yielded a more sensitive, slightly less specific, but more sensitive test for PE. Other secondary parameters were, you know, hey, are we able to do this reliably? We showed that among people of different experience levels, we were able to get a kappa of fairly high.
Yeah, that was quite good. So most of these signs that you demonstrated were reproducible amongst a group of people who were fairly POCUS savvy.
Yeah, correct. And so that part measured well. And essentially, TAPSE was shown to be a good predictor of PE, potentially just as good, a little bit at the same level as McConnell sign, with the other parameters being less sensitive or specific in independence.
Yeah. And did you have a wee subset of hypertensive tachy patients? Do I remember
we had,
right?
Yes. So they did do, it turns out like about 17 of those 150 subjects were hypotensive and tachycardic, in which case using TAPSE or, you know, focus in general was sensitive to 94%.
Yeah. So like a lot of things, when you've got sick people, it's probably a more useful test. Yeah.
So overall, a good test. And the way it probably needs to go forward is seeing the outcomes from having a positive TAPSE in the first place.
Yeah, what do you do based on that information? So for this study, your test under investigation was your echo and your signs of right ventricular dysfunction. These were all done before CT scan.
For the most part, most of them were done.
And there was about a 20% rule-in rate for PE, which is quite high. Certainly in the States, it's quite a high rule-in rate for CTPA.
And in this study, you actually compared the qualitative, kind of just looking at the TAPSE, to how well when it was actually measured, and that seemed to really correlate quite well. I think there was like a cap of a 0.94 for that.
Yeah.
So that makes me think that maybe you don't necessarily need to measure it, which, as you mentioned, can sometimes be difficult. If you can just see that annulus moving and you get a good idea, is it moving a lot? Is it moving just a little bit? That might be helpful.
So that's something reproducible between different practitioners.
The thing is, you might be able to estimate it not using an apical four chamber. So if you got a subxiphoid and you were somehow able to do like a sideways TAPSE, that could be just as predictive as an apical four chamber vertical TAPSE.
I think that's got to be a new concept, a sideways TAPSE.
I'm going to name it the sideways TAPSE.
You can certainly estimate that.
You heard it here.
Yeah.
Can I ask one question? I suppose primarily of Catherine and Ashley. Is your assessment of the right heart in the ICU in the general pneumonia patients, or say the acute core pulmonary patient, is that different from the assessment of the right heart in a PE patient? Is it the same signs you're looking for, or are you looking for something different?
For me, same signs.
Same signs. What are pulmonary artery pressures? Because we generally don't seem to see these measured in these PE studies. At least it wasn't in the boiler of these.
I don't routinely measure
them. Pulmonary artery pressure is one of the easiest things to measure an echo. You just go to an inflow view, and it lines up really nicely with your continuous wave Doppler. You can find it in nearly every ICU patient. Very easy just to stick your continuous wave trace down and measure it.
And do you find it useful? That's the question. Because obviously there's interventions. Obviously they can get sildenafil and all the rest that's occasionally used in the severe right heart failure in ICU patients. But
so right heart strain on intensive care is nearly always because a patient has been fluid overloaded. Right. And they just need fluid taking off and then they get better. And you can make it very complicated, or you can just not fluid overload them to start with, or you can dry them out afterwards when you found it.
Would be agreement? Because I know, and if you go on in the wet ICUs versus the dry ICUs, this could be a real point of contention. But
I think Ashley's edging towards the dry ICU concept there, and so am I.
Right. Okay. So that seems to be the general trend.
Hypovolemia does not exist on intensive care.
Yeah. One of my nephrology colleagues call himself a fluid Taliban. He's very strict.
I once worked on an ICU, the ICU where John Hines worked on. Actually, I was an SHO there a long, long time ago, and they were incredibly dry, and it was not uncommon to give 250 milligrams of furosemide as a routine bolus dose. And then I moved to New Zealand, and I worked in a unit that was generally quite liberal with fluids, and they'd be fully resuscitated, and then when they get to the resuscitation phase, they're all puffy, and they're now getting better, and they want to get the fluid off. And the first dose I was given when I moved there was given 5 milligrams of furosemide, and I laughed out loud. I would give him 5 milligrams of furosemide and he peed 2 liters. So it's when you're that fluid overloaded, it does seem to work. It's very interesting.
I do a lot of work in step down units with just non-invasive ventilation and stuff, and we get, as you know, all the COPD patients who are sort of on the verge of crashing and stuff, and I find it quite useful to at least have a look at the right heart, see what's going on, because that's not so uncommon. One of the causes is that the right heart isn't working as well as, and just to get a measurement from the start before the non-invasive, before I put them on the BiPAP or something like that, and see what's happening, and just following them. Sometimes it's really useful information why they're not getting better, or why they keep on collecting fluid, or how much fluid I should give them and stuff.
As another collection of anecdotes, because that's what I'm kind of going down at this stage. In ICU, commonest cause of right heart dysfunction is fluid overload. In ED, I think a lot of it's either pre-existing right heart dysfunction or hypoxia, probably, because we see patients at the front door with SATs of 75. And I've seen lots of people who I'm doing the echo as they arrive in. They've got big dilated right hearts, or they've got a raised PA pressure or something like that. You give them a bit of oxygen and you repeat it, and all that's gone away. Like literally within 30 minutes, they can have quite dynamic changes.
It's interesting that you say that, because many people who go to arrest will tell you the same when they're doing peri-arrest echoes, that universally the right heart looks dilated.
And that's all down to either left ventricular failure or because of hypoxia, either of those will call those.
Okay. I think it shows how, you know, you can use our ultrasound as a tool to watch things as they evolve dynamically.
I think that's concerning, though, because a lot of people would be using ultrasound in cardiac arrest to try to find an etiology of the arrest. And if they suspect that there's pulmonary embolism, that may cause some people to want to give thrombolytics in that case.
And I agree with you, Mike. So I think only time will tell.
Yeah, there's actually a study that I saw recently that was done in pigs where they...
We actually discussed this on the Archive podcast. I chose it, but anyway, continue.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So they took pigs and induced an arrest, and they tried to figure out if they had signs of right heart strain in other causes of arrest besides from pulmonary embolism, and they found that it's not as specific for like a PE or right heart strain as they thought initially, because some of the, from what I remember, a lot of the pigs had dilated RVs from other causes.
Everybody has dilated RVs. The commonest cause, again, in people of walking around of right heart failure is left heart failure. That's the commonest cause. And walking around people, not ICU patients necessarily.
And pigs.
And pigs, obviously, as well. That's a fascinating paper. I love that paper.
So I'm curious, in your step-down unit, how you treat the patients with right heart failure. You know, you've ultrasounded them before you start, and how you treat them differently to the other patients.
Fluid Talibanism, yeah. And lower pressures, of course, if they can tolerate it. that's about, I mean, sometimes we've given milrinone, is that what it's called?
Yes.
Which I actually find works quite well.
I find that works quite well too. Although sometimes then when they leave the ICU, you know, it's pretty difficult to get outside the ICU. Yeah, so
maybe that's because they're leaving the ICU. Not because.
And sometimes I think when you need to use milrinone, those type of patients, it's an indicator of how severe their disease is.
But it's same thing for me. It's also sort of an indicator that this might go to hell during the night or whatever. So I can report it to my colleagues or be extra cautious and this and that. It's more of a... I get more of a feeling on how sick this patient is and how much I need to really look after them.
What's a fluid Taliban?
They're very strict with fluids.
So what does that mean?
So a proper doctor.
How strict?
So any other thoughts on the right heart? We've kind of right-hearted everybody out. Anyone want to put in before we
move on? I completely agree with you that the TR should be measured more and more and more. It's one of the easiest measurements we can do. Yeah.
If once you've learned focused echo, the next step up is going to be PA pressure measurement.
It should.
So routinely, what would you find their baseline TR is in a COPD patient who, you know, has been in and out of hospital?
Yeah, and you never know. That's more surprising. But they might look perfectly fine, but you have a beautiful flattened septum and a pressure of 80 or something like that. But it's also usually they've had an echo from before, so I can compare it from before and see if they're deteriorating or getting better or whatever. If it's the same, so it's more of a comparison.
Look at the values from before. Look at the values now.
Yeah.
I just wanted to point out that I think what this paper was looking at initially was, can you use TAPSE to help you diagnose pulmonary embolism? And I don't know if a lot of us are using ultrasound to rule out their pulmonary embolisms right now. So
I see a lot. It's all silent checking heads here. It doesn't come across well in an audio podcast, yes. But we all agree.
So even though TAPSE wasn't super sensitive for PE, I think you have to ask yourself, are you going to use ultrasound to try to rule it out anyways? And if from all the evidence that I've seen, if you really want to do this for some reason, maybe you don't have... you know, other diagnostics available, you really have to do very comprehensive cardiac, lung, and vein ultrasound if you're trying to rule it out.
Yeah. I often use ultrasound to stop heparin on people who've been started on it. When they come into the hospital with a respiratory failure, a PE is part of the differential diagnosis. They're started on heparin. But if you then scan the lungs, you find pathology, you scan the heart, there's no right heart problem. You scan the leg veins, there's no clot. You know, you've seen the pneumonia, stop the heparin.
And are they started on heparin before definitive imaging?
That'd be quite common in the UK and Ireland.
Yeah. Oh, all right, okay. Yeah. So no CT, no comment.
Lots of people will come in an evening, and then the next morning they've had heparin, they've not had a CTPA.
They get the full package, antibiotics, cortisone, furosemide,
fluids,
heparin, fruity juice,
Lasix, fluid, cool,
moxifrizumol,
I'd agree
effective exacerbation of heart failure.
And the heparin's not without risk. I'm sure all of us have seen, you know, the odd psoas hematoma, GI bleed.
2 weeks ago.
You know, what are the chances of having two major diagnoses?
Although whether there's any evidence for using that ultrasound approach for ruling out a PE, there probably isn't, but it just seems sensible.
Don't tell any of my bosses because I'm a trainee, but occasionally we have difficulties with access to Doppler imaging for the lower limb in terms of our definitive imaging. So often we'll send people home on a Friday to come back for a scan of their leg on a Monday. We'll give them some either low molecular weight heparin or a DOAC over the weekend to cover them. And occasionally I just scan them and say it's nothing big and just hold the anticoagulation until they come back from the scan.
I do the exact same, especially if we're looking.
You're a grown-up doctor, you're allowed to do that.
I think we're all on the journey, on the pathway with imaging. But yeah, I think it's a really useful approach to do that is say, I know there's probably not
a large, and it's the same way you're looking at the right heart, you know there's not a large PE. Still go ahead and get your CTPA, do what you want, but there's not a large PE if there's not a big right heart strain.
And of course, these people that we're talking about sending home obviously look well clinically. They're not incredibly hypoxic or tachycardic or in distress. So if you're worried about just missing that small PE in those patients that maybe you would anticoagulate them. So I use it the same exact way where I'm not able to get a comprehensive venous ultrasound 24 hours a day. So a lot of times instead of starting them on anticoagulation, I'll just do my own ultrasound, and if it's negative, I feel like that at least puts them at a lower risk, and so I hold the anticoagulation until they get their follow-up scan, which usually can be done the next day.
And you know what? It's all about risk stratification. I think that's what we're expert at as acute physicians, is risk stratification of the patient. Say, do we need to, is it outside the risk level that we're able to accept by the tests that we can do, or are we able to stratify them lower, and can we move on that?
All right, a lot of great pearls and discussion in there. Thanks for listening to this part two of the series. Again, a big shout out of thanks to Andy Neal for doing all the editing of this podcast. The audio will also be released on the RCEM Learning podcast. You can learn more about them at rcemlearning.co.uk. Feel free to leave us feedback on the website ultrasoundgel.org under this episode, or you can contact us by email, Twitter, Facebook, Google+. I look forward to hearing from you, and we will talk to you later.
More pressure, more gel, more pressure, more gel.
Ultrasound Gel Podcast.